The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about Blade Runner 2049.
Yes.
I'm Andrew, and with me today are
Maddie
and
Steve.
And unfortunately, we don't have Ty with us today. So, in the absence of Ty, Alexa, tell me about Blade Runner 2049.
Blade Runner 2049 is a 2017 science fiction film starring Harrison Ford, Ryan Gosling and Ana de Armas. A young Blade Runner's discovery of a long-buried secret leads him to track down former Blade Runner Rick Deckard, who's been missing for 30 years. Its runtime is 2 hours, 44 minutes. It has an IMDb rating of 8.6 out of 10 and is rated 15.
We truly are living in the future.
I don't think we need Ty anymore. Alexa, what's Bristol Bad Film Club?
Sorry, I'm not sure.
Oh, we do need Ty. Who wrote the music for Blade Runner 2049?
Blade Runner 2049's musical composers are Hans Zimmer, Johan Johansson, and Benjamin Wallfish.
Actually, while we're on that, Johan Johansson isn't on the soundtrack. His music was all removed. Did you know this?
No.
So, Johan Johansson, who wrote that amazing soundtrack for Arrival, worked with Denis Villeneuve on Arrival.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, when they started making Blade Runner 2049, Johan Johansson was on the music writing credits, but he was writing something, as you can probably imagine, he was writing something which was very much his own thing. And Denis Villeneuve decided at some point, and they decided together, it said, he wanted to go back to something closer to the Vangelis music from the first one, so that's when he got in the other guys.
I was massively impressed with the soundtrack, both how it harked back to the original Blade Runner and how it was a little bit different.
Yeah, I believe that Hans Zimmer's composing skill is particularly honed to sort of aping something else, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
He can do his own thing. He does his own thing really well as well, but whereas Johan Johansson is sort of so completely singular. His music is so really, I mean, Hans Zimmer's music is incredibly distinctive too, but from when we were talking to the guys about Planet Earth and they were talking about his composing style, he was really good at kind of creating something from what was already there.
Yeah, he did a fantastic job kind of emulating stuff from the original, but for me personally there wasn't enough synth. Do enjoy a good bit of synth.
Yeah.
And lots of...
Yeah, that was good, though. Yeah. That was good.
It was like a cross between Interstellar and Blade Runner, the original, the soundtrack. You know what I'm saying? You can hear some of that kind of...
I was confused at times about what was a sound effect and what was a soundtrack.
Mm. You get that bit with Zimmer, don't you, though?
Yeah.
And there's also good use of silence, too.
Mm.
Yeah. Good. So we rewatched the original Blade Runner here in the shed. It's the first time we've actually watched the film in the shed this last weekend. And they use silence in that original film as well. It felt like when they were having the conversations inside buildings, it was much more intimate sound. Not just the music, but the whole sound was more intimate, whereas when you're outside it really opens up and uses all of the surround sound here in the shed and the surround sound in the cinema really beautifully. We've started on the sound, which is weird.
That's very unlike us.
It's a significant part of that movie, and it does blow you away. I actually saw the screen vibrating at times because of the bass. Yeah. The use of spaces in the movie was really impressive as well. The number of different sets and scenes they had and the way they used it from... I'm going to spoil the hell out of this. From
Oh, yeah, we should do that. Let's do a quick spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the film, literally stop now. Go and see it. If you see one film on the big screen this year, it has to be this. It is amazing to look at, to listen to. Just... even if you don't like the original Blade Runner, you've got no interest in seeing it, you've read terrible reviews, ignore them, go and see it. And I don't even want to worry if you don't come back and listen to this. Just go and see the film. Carry on, Steve.
Totally seconded. Spoilers starting now. Yeah. So from the cityscapes that really hark back to the last movie, with the Los Angeles sea wall which they show you, but they don't talk about. And there's so much in that film that isn't explicitly stated. There's a real world that they've created or built upon. To the San Diego trash pile, which the three spherical things that they go into when they're in that scene down in San Diego, I'm not sure if they meant it to, but there's a nuclear power plant just north of San Diego that you drive past on Highway 1, and they reminded me of that, so I don't know if they're intending that to
maybe
be that. To Las Vegas. I'm like, what's going on there?
It actually took me a little while to clock that it was Las Vegas, even though it showed us the map. Like, oh, he's there. And they had like all the casino sort of, and they got all the, was it whiskey? Yeah, it was whiskey. I was going to say rum then. Was it?
Well,
got
bourbon.
Poured all the whiskey drinks. But yeah, even just in the original, there's a whole lot of kind of neon, very sort of dark settings, and that was just amazingly captured in the new one.
The place where the Nexus 8, lives, that we see right at the start, in the sort of barren wasteland. What is it, California solar farms and stuff?
Yeah, there were loads of solar bits, wasn't there?
With this weird fog that seems to be everywhere on the West Coast.
Everything natural seemed to be dead, even though he was a farmer. So he was like farming these what looked like super big maggots.
Mealworm sort of things.
Mealworm type stuff.
It's the future.
The thing that I loved most, probably amongst all this, the thing that I loved most about the film was the pace of it. You could sit there and enjoy the visuals, enjoy the sound, enjoy the story, enjoy the performance. You could enjoy all of it for the entire time that the film was on.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, not that there's anything particularly wrong with, but it wasn't fast edit cuts that we're used to these days. It was much more like Arrival. Denis Villeneuve's other science fiction film, and Blade Runner in the past. And if anything that's disappointed me about Blade Runner 2049, it's that people haven't gone to see it in enough numbers. I worry that the studios will say this kind of storytelling is not populist enough, so they won't make more films like this, which I think is a shame, because it could be, this and Arrival could be the beginning of some really intelligent science fiction.
I've heard people criticise this movie and the original Blade Runner for not being fast-paced enough. And yeah, I think maybe it is a culture or a style thing that we're not used to. I really liked it as well. And actually, I've seen it 1.5 times because I got called up for an emergency work call halfway through the first time we watched it.
I felt for you then. I had real empathy for you.
Oh, it was awful. Anyway, watching it the second time, watching the first half of it...
I felt for us when we came out and couldn't talk about it.
Watching the first half the second time was even better with the pacing and just being able to look at all of the details of the world that they've created there.
I think they're definitely films that you need to watch several times to truly appreciate, particularly like the original. I've half seen it many occasions and then watched it the whole way through about a year ago and then again on Friday. And like second time around, I was actually way more absorbed into it. Maybe it's because I was getting ready for seeing Ryan Gosling. Who knows? I think it's definitely something that you need to watch a few times to truly appreciate. I don't think it necessarily translates the first time because it is so different to what we're used to in terms of like cult films.
The other scene, the other space that really sticks in my mind is Wallace Corp HQ, which is just the most bizarre office space in the world.
Yeah, and it had all the, replicants floating in, the weird pickled jelly stuff.
That's kind of, you see headquarters having their product in the foyer or whatever. But this guy's office is, it looks like the inside of a giant golden pyramid with a floating platform in the middle of it. And then the archives are all very...
Yeah, it's almost like a video game.
As well.
Yeah.
It was very film noir.
Yeah.
And then Wallace's character, Jared Leto, played it. I think he played it well. It's a weird character, and he made me feel weird to be around. But then I think that's part of the movie, right?
Yeah, I think he's fascinating. I've read some people complaining about the fact that he's in it. I've not knowingly seen him in anything else. I don't think I've ever seen any of the films that he's in.
I've heard his name. What else has he done?
Is he in the band or something?
Alexa
as well.
What films has Jared Leto been in?
The films that Jared Leto is a star in include Suicide Squad, Blade Runner 2049, American Psycho and Requiem for a Dream. To see more, check out the Alexa app.
I've seen him in Suicide Squad. Okay. I quite liked him in that.
Okay.
He's also a weird character there.
Quite a lot of weird characters, actually. Yeah. That little selection okay. that
well,
were shared.
As I say, I've not seen them. An interesting thing is that Denis Villeneuve had originally intended that character to be played by David Bowie.
Oh!
I could see that working.
Yeah. He actually said that he felt like the whole of the first film was kind of inspired a little bit by David Bowie, and he felt that his presence was there throughout the first film, in a way, for him, and that he really felt like he was going to be a really key part, because that otherworldly, you don't know if he's good or bad, he's not part of humanity, in a way, kind of feeling that you get sometimes from David Bowie. Or Bowie as well.
There's a computer game that Bowie was involved with. I don't know if he just did the soundtrack or he had a role in creating the world, but it was called Omicron the Nomad Soul, and it wasn't as popular as I think it should have been. It was a great game, and it had another sort of weird creative world that I imagine was inspired or could have inspired that world.
Well, apparently he was going to... at the moment when he was going to approach David Bowie and ask him, that was when he died, and so it never happened. But you can definitely see that, and knowing that, then the way that Jared Leto plays it, I'd never having seen him before anything else, I can't judge his performance really based on anything else, as I say. But the way he plays it is otherworldly. And because he hasn't got any eyes, I mean, the eyes are so key in Blade Runner, and that whole, you know, eyes being the key to the soul and everything. And you can't see his eyes. You know, his eyes are completely blank. So you've got no way of knowing what he's feeling, really. And I think it's fascinating the way it's done.
There's a YouTube channel that I really like called The Nerd Writer, who talks about films in a really, really good way. He's got a video called Children of Men Don't Ignore the Background. And it talks about all the stuff that happens on camera but is unspoken about, like the news reports in the background and the attitude of people in the background of the scenes. And how you can create a world or add to a world with stuff that isn't necessarily core plot. So highly recommend people watch that.
We should definitely do Children of Men as well as a film in the Cosmic Shed. Let's do that. But also with you saying, Steve, about looking into the world, I feel like that's what these two films do. In a way, I don't really know why I like the first one. Like, the story is not amazing. I don't really feel like I connect with any of the characters. The love story between the two of them doesn't make any sense to me. I don't get it, but I love it. And I think it's because it creates a world that we can escape into. And it asks really interesting questions. I think the story in the new one is considerably better. The characters, you can really start to empathise with them and see their motivations and understand where they're coming from a bit. But it also has that massive ambiguity of, well, what are their motivations? What are they thinking? And you just... It's never overtly stated. Like that scene at the end where when he's in front of Joy, who we should come to as well, the massive representation of Joy, this kind of ridiculous, grotesque advert for everything you could possibly want, everything you could possibly need. And you don't know. It's never overtly stated. You can read that scene in so many different ways. The way that I read it was he had been part of this journey. He's seen that there is a greater purpose. Joy is an android, but a more simple android, whose entire purpose is to please its owner, her owner. He, at that point, is thinking, well, I could go and get another one of those. But the sheer ridiculous, almost vulgar size of the whole thing makes him realise how ridiculous this world is, and that really it's about that idea that what you would do as a human is die for a cause that you believe in, or in fact live for a cause that you believe in, which I think is probably more human than dying for it.
How did they make Rachel look so much like Rachel?
I don't think she looked that much like Rachel.
I thought it was spot on.
I think it was an actress that was chosen to almost look like her but be different so we could empathise with Decker a bit. I didn't notice the eye colour, but I think she was different enough. Rachel's got a really striking look in the first Blade Runner.
I think it's just
that the CGI isn't quite there.
I thought it was an actress that was...
No, I think it... Well, I don't know, but
there's an embargo on the CGI talk until October the 27th. So maybe we'll talk about that then. There's so much to say about the way that this film looks. We may reference it again, but we are going to do another episode on Blade Runner 2049 because I've arranged a couple of interviews with some of the people who worked on the set design and the CG stuff on this film, but they're not allowed to talk about it. It's embargoed until October the 27th.
Mm.
So we'll be back with that at some point.
Mm. In Wallace Corp, Jared Leto's Enterprise, there's a scene where like a fully grown adult replicant is just birthed from like a massive sack, almost like a womb, right?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure how I feel about the whole robot giving birth thing, because in my mind that is probably not a robot, that's like some kind of life that you've artificially created.
But then
I don't think that should be called a robot.
Okay.
I feel like a robot has to have some kind of mechanical process, whether that's like an actuation thing that's like not necessarily electronically controlled, but it's something that's kind of built with like mechanical stuff as opposed to like growing like effectively a human body as a robot. I'm not sure what that would be called.
A replicant.
A replicant. Which that in itself kind of implies it's like replicated from humans. Some of the caveats of like life evolving from organic matter and organic systems is that it has to be able to replicate itself, like self-replication. It's how like DNA self-replicates to produce other cells, that kind of base level.
They're definitely designed in some way. They're customised and they can limit their lifespan, change their attitude, that sort of stuff. But I think they refer to them as clones at some point. I don't think we're told whether the origin of replicant's DNA is originally human or if it's completely artificial. Mm. There's certainly a very good approximation of humans if they're completely engineered from scratch. But given the darkness of Wallace Corp and Tyrell, I wouldn't be surprised if they were human clones. And that, to me, makes the whole thing a lot darker.
It's something that we're exploring in science fiction now. At the science fiction of today, like Westworld, the way that we treat replicants and androids and robots. Like there's this question is whether Deckard is a replicant or not, and it's kind of really key to the first film. But actually, I don't care. For me, and one of the points of this world that they've created is that is really hard to tell. And how could you possibly tell? Whereas I think in the past we were talking about robots were going to take over. We're now looking at ourselves and saying, well, maybe we're going to treat them appallingly when they get up to this level. Because we're certainly treating each other appallingly and all the other animals on Earth appallingly. So why wouldn't we?
Deliberate reference to that in Wallace's speech about colonising 9 planets, colonising more, needing trillions of replicants and I'm not sure about his motivation. He's using them as a tool to expand life in the universe, which is an interesting contrast to where we are today with large and increasingly growing population being a problem, whereas he wants to use it as a tool to expand.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe he sees their lives as sacrificial, because if you're going to send robots to like other planets or other parts of space... Like, one of the big issues with doing that with people, obviously, is the ageing factor and a whole other load of ethical stuff. Mm. So, obviously, if you send these replicants, they could be effectively dormant for hundreds of years and then live their lifespan, and then it would all be recorded in their eyeballs.
But his motivation, like, he wants them to procreate so that he can make more tools or slaves.
I can't see any reason why we would actually build replicants.
The stated need for the replicants is colonising other worlds, and they need slave labour to do that, because that's apparently the only way you can progress as a society.
The nickel is for the colonial ships, closest any of them or any of us is going to get to that grand life off-world. So come on now. What sort do you have in mind? Because I got all kinds.
Yeah, just on that. I mean, it feels so repugnant to us now, doesn't it, that slavery could even be considered as an option for people, or indeed replicants in the film. It feels so horrendous. And I think that's interesting, the way that morality changes over the years. You know, there isn't this set morality where we say this, we all know innately that somehow something's good or bad. And morality just so clearly changes over the years. If you take this quote from Leviticus in the Bible, which says, "You may purchase male or female slaves from among the foreigners who live among you. You may also purchase the children of such resident foreigners, including those who have been born in your land. You may treat them as your property, passing them on to your children as a permanent inheritance. You may treat your slaves like this, but the people of Israel, your relatives, must never be treated this way." That's Leviticus 25:44-46. I mean, that's just repugnant to us now. But clearly back then, that was seen as the right morality.
Quite an experience to live in fear, isn't it? That's what it is to be a slave.
Harrison Ford, for all his wonderful treasures that he's given us, is possibly not always used amazingly well as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Have I said that okay? I don't want to upset him.
I think that was legitimately phrased.
Okay. But I think he's really good in this film. I think, you know, he's the difference between him in the original Blade Runner and this one is quite remarkable. You know, he's a man who's sacrificed everything for his daughter. In the same way that Joy is a android who's designed to just make one thing happy, he's done everything to make his daughter live. And it's kind of a running theme, isn't it? And the Joe K character, it was worked all that time thinking it was for himself. Turns out it wasn't for himself, and he's okay with that. You know, his motivation turns out to be entirely selfless.
After a fairly emotional transition.
Yeah, but he gets there. And
yeah, and obviously Harrison Ford's acting has come on a lot, as you'd expect it to in 35 years.
I was trying not to say that.
no offence, but he's got 35 years more experience.
Yeah, yeah. As I say, it's a world. They've created a world, the two of them. The two films have made this world, which is just fascinating to look into. And I don't want answers, I want questions. The questions are fascinating, and I don't really want the answers.
I hope they make more, though.
Do you?
I don't want them to. I think if they, you know, suck the blood out of it, like they do with so many other, like, franchise films, it would just ruin it.
Hmm.
I can see the two standing alone pretty much as equals, actually. I think this sequel, of all the sequels, stands next to the original very, very well, possibly because of the distance between them. But I think there's a lot more that they can get out of that world, a lot more exploration they can do. And if they, as long as they don't go away from the pacing and the tone, I can see maybe one or two more films being good additions. Although you've always got the curse of the trilogy, haven't you?
Yeah.
Okay, should we do some science?
Yeah, probably. I could talk about this all day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got another episode to talk about, right, so don't worry about it. I particularly want to talk about that scene where Joy and Joe kiss. It's phenomenal, you know, but we'll do that in the next episode.
The first one, or in the rain?
No, when they do more than kiss, but you know, when she gets the sex worker in to help with the whole thing.
Mackenzie Davis.
So, yeah, it is so incredibly done, just amazing. But we'll talk about it in the next scene. Maybe talk to somebody who was involved in...
Well, yeah, it's an interesting contrast to the sex scene in the original movie, which was almost like rape, I felt, initially. Because he was very much forcing her to kiss him in the first Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, it was like, oh, I've done this for you.
Yeah.
So I'm your obedient servant toy.
Yes.
Thing.
Yeah. But that's, you know, okay, let's do that then, before we do some science.
Sorry.
No. Because there's been some criticism of the film as being sexist.
Mm-hmm.
My reading, I can understand it, I can see why people say it, but I felt watching it that it was completely the opposite.
and that what they've done is created a dystopian future where a single megalomaniac man had brought society to a really dreadful place, along with the rest of society, by doing things that were sexist. It is representing an awful future where women have been treated appallingly. And those huge, like, one of the complaints that I saw about it being a sexist film is that those huge statues of naked women with open mouths.
Mm. In the desert.
Yeah. Mm. And it's like, but I don't understand how you can see that and not see it as grotesque and just, it's so obvious. It's not a celebration of that. It's a denigration of that. It's just, this is awful. I mean, I can't, maybe it's just the way I look at it. Maybe it's just the way that I see the world, but I can't see how you can see that as sexist. It is so obvious to me that that statement is, look at how grotesque it is, the way that we do this. And
yeah, also just be given that that is Vegas, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Like the home of, like, pretty much,
that's a dystopia,
tacky,
in itself,
tacky, disgusting,
yeah,
repulsive,
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah,
I agree with you, Andrew and Maddie, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a dystopia, and it's not meant to be where anyone's suggesting we want to go to as a society. Putting it in the context of a film that people watch today, it's a valid comment to say that these scenes in this film can be seen as sexist, as something that
then you've
definitely
also,
debatable. But
you've also got Madam in quite a high position
who gets killed by another
woman. Yeah,
what I would say, right, a powerful woman in that film.
Yeah, the henchman, henchman of Wallace.
What I'm saying is, I think the criticism is valid in one light of this is a film that's in cinemas right now, but in terms of in that world, no, it's definitely not glorifying it.
No, it's not the perfect feminist film by any stretch of the imagination, but I just think it's missing the point completely on this one to see it that way. But I might be that I just see it different. I get that. I see that I might just be seeing it differently. But I can't see how anyone can see that scene with the massive naked joy thing and think anything other than, oh my God, that's ridiculous. And it's not so far from what we
it's
do
disgusting.
Today.
Yeah.
It's like in Ex Machina. It's a similar thing in Ex Machina. None of the nudity in Ex Machina is in any way titillating, I don't think. It's just so grotesque, the way that people and robots are being treated in that film. And it's a very similar thing with this. And
in Ex Machina, the what's the guy's name? The robot creator guy.
Ethan?
From Star Wars.
Ethan, yeah. He's definitely a very disturbed man, and the things that he does are meant to disgust us.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to remember that the relationship that Kay has with his joy is a little bit more equal standing. Like, obviously he controls her, but like he got her that thing to put so that she could go with him from like the hub or whatever it was,
the emanator,
that there we go, whatever it was called. And I was like, oh, that's actually quite sweet, because it seemed like the two of them actually had like a nice relationship.
And
the thing that broke him was when the emanator got broken.
Even though it's like she is the face of however many other hundreds of thousands of people have that toy, it's not really a toy, that virtual presence in their lives. But is it, Kay and Joy, the Joy that we see, seem to have a very, like, fairly good standing relationship.
And the fact that he is, is a replicant who has that toy, to me is different from
a human.
The way that I'd see a human having that toy.
Interesting.
Well, the replicants are slaves.
Yeah.
And even Kay is a slave. And but the fact that he has a house and a life and a sex toy
and possessions.
And, is interesting. But he's still beholden to the whims of LAPD and Madam.
But she's not a sex toy, is she? She wants to become a sexual partner for him. definitely for him, but she's not a sex doll. She is a servant, in effect. She's a pretend wife servant.
But he's caught up in it as well.
Yeah, he is. But like at the beginning, I think this is something that the love story in the original Blade Runner doesn't do. It doesn't sell you on it at all. It's just you're just supposed to accept that they love each other. When clearly they just fancy each other, but which is fair. But the like when it first starts, she's changing all those things. He's changing, trying to find the thing that makes him happiest, and he's sort of almost emotionless, going, "Please don't just be the thing to please me. You don't have to do that. Don't do it because you please me." He wants her to be more autonomous, and he goes to get that thing to make her more autonomous. He wants her to be more. And we don't know whether when she screams "I love you" just as she dies, whether she means it or it's just what she's supposed to say. But he definitely wants her to be more than she is.
I didn't watch it and think, "Oh god, that's really sexist."
Yeah.
Yeah, I was more disgusted, and I did think it was a bit weird that, I mean, it was a lot more sexualized than in the original.
Yeah,
but then that's what happens.
Please do tweet us at the Cosmic Shed if you agree or disagree.
Completely, I'm very willing to be proven wrong on everything. Do we think we are anywhere near replicants?
In short, no.
Seconded.
Thirded.
End the show.
Yeah, but why would we?
Drop out.
The technology we have today, as far as I'm aware, is nowhere near it. We've got robots that can walk fairly well.
There's fantastic YouTube compilations of walking robots falling over.
Yeah. Well, that's what our robot overlords in the future are going to refer back to with the Boston Dynamics videos of robots being kicked and pushed and made to slip over.
And all the cat videos.
Yeah, robot abuse and cats is what the 21st century is about. But we've got robots that can walk. And we're very close to having robots that can walk effectively. We haven't got robots that can self-replicate like that, although the replicants can't yet, apart from that one case. But we do have research on self-replicating robots. We've got the whole sort of field of nanorobotics, which
grey goo, right?
The grey goo thing. That's a different outcome from self-replicating. We've got there are 3D printers that can print other 3D printers, but they need people to stick them together, and they need other
hardware.
They're
all kind of fixed purpose, behave in a fixed way or fixed pattern of sequences.
And in terms of the computation and software challenge of creating something that can pretend to be human, there's attempts, and there's websites you can go onto and chat to chatbots and probably be somewhat fooled for a little while. I think there was something a couple of months ago there was a chatbot that supposedly passed the Turing test. Now, I'm not sure if it was a stupid person that they were talking to.
And then you've got these robots that can beat, like, world-class players of chess or Go or whatever. And obviously there's loads of different combinations of moves that are possible to do, but it's a computer kind of statistically going through and working stuff out in order to choose the next move. So there's not a predefined sequence of which moves they will use. There's a predefined sequence of how they will choose the next move that they will do. So in that way, they adapt to the situation that they're in, but it's not really like thinking in the way, in the sense that you or I would think.
Yeah, and so we've
definitely not with emotions.
No, we've got robots and computers that can do one thing a lot better than human beings can. But in terms of being human and being as adaptive and resilient and communicative and emotional as we are, then I don't think we're anywhere near.
But is that a goal of robotics in any sense, to do that?
There are people working towards trying to replicate human intelligence in a robot, but it's a problem that we still don't have a a great grasp on.
But I feel like the Turing test, this idea of trying to fool people into thinking that a robot is a... Alexa, what is the Turing test?
The Turing test, developed by Alan Turing in 1950, is a test of a machine's ability to exhibit intelligent behavior equivalent to, or indistinguishable from, that of a human.
Thanks, Alexa. But if you are doing that, then I feel like that's more of a game. Like, it's more of a game. I feel like it was more of a game for Alan Turing. I don't know. I wasn't in his head. But I feel like it was a game to progress computing rather than a goal in itself.
Yeah, it was, like, logical thinking.
Yeah.
It was a benchmark, I think. But fooling a human into believing that this machine is a human doesn't, to me, replicate human intelligence in any way. It is a game. It's fooling people. Alexa, could you pass the Turing test?
I don't need to pass that. I'm not pretending to be human.
Exactly.
That's a good answer.
She is sassy. I love it.
But exactly. Why would you do that? Why would you try and... Apart from a coding, computing point of view, it's an interesting thing to try and do, but it doesn't really help us in any way.
Alexa, how are you feeling?
I'm very well, thanks.
Alexa, are you an artificial intelligence?
That's right. Hi.
Oh, she's overconfident, I would say. Well, in a way, she is. Well, she's certainly got computers on her back end over at Amazon that are crunching a lot of numbers and using what we'd call artificial intelligence algorithm.
Yeah. But she's essentially a voice-activated search engine.
Yeah. But with added bonuses, like, for example, Alexa, open the bay doors.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that. I'm not Hal and we're not in space.
You see?
Alexa, cease all motor functions.
I don't know that.
She can admit when she's wrong. That's more than most humans. Well, she can't do something. So do you reckon, you know, when Kay comes back into the LAPD and he goes through this kind of, like, test where the baseline test. The computer kind of says loads of sentences and he has to respond with, like, cells or, like, in between or, like, stuff like that. Is that some kind of Turing test to test that he's still at a certain level in his robotic development? Because if they're designed to develop and grow and get some kind of emotional education during their day-to-day lives, then I guess they would have to check that, right? Yeah. And then if they're starting to get too intelligent...
Too emotional.
Yeah, then flags are raised.
It's kind of almost like, because in the original film it's the Voight-Kampff test, which is sort of an empathy test, really, and seeing.
But that's designed to provoke a response, isn't it? Whereas this one's designed to maybe measure their emotional state.
It was a response time, wasn't it?
Yeah, to check whether what they've been through has made them their baseline emotion too much for them to go back out into the field.
Which brings another ethical question in, like, if they have the ability to get more emotional and react to their feelings in a way that their human masters don't want them to do. There's a whole ethical conundrum there about them being almost oppressed.
Yeah.
And back to your question about, are we going to have robots like this? That is why it's so hard, because we know how brains work to a certain extent, but we obviously don't know how they work in terms of connecting different emotions and experiences and why people react in certain ways in certain situations. And until we can kind of emulate that, then we're probably not going to get robots like this.
Mm. I'm delighted to say that for the first time in a long time, and hopefully now regular again, here's Ben.
For this episode, and it's been a long time since Andrew has given me a commission... But for this episode, Andrew pointed me towards Pale Fire by Nabokov. And for everyone who's seen the film, will realise that that's a big part of Blade Runner 2049. I hadn't read it. I had a look at it. And it's a novel with a poem embedded inside it. I think it's a 999... stanza poem, with 1,000 stanza lost as part of the story of the book. So unfortunately I didn't get around to reading it, but I have my starting point for this work, today's work, I'm not going to call it a poem, was that Nabokov book. And the second starting point was that I have always been really fascinated by the animals and the kind of animal motifs in the original Blade Runner film. The owl and the snake and the dove, particularly the ostrich, which appears in an early scene in the marketplace. Yeah, I think it was pointed out in one of the director's commentaries how much work they put into getting this ostrich in that marketplace just for one very short shot. And then reading the source book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, it's actually an ostrich is the catalyst for the entire plot. So I thought I would try and write a poem about an ostrich. I haven't written a poem about an ostrich, but I have written a treatment for an epic poem about an ostrich. All right, so this is a treatment for a poem called 5 Centimeters Across, in heroic couplets consisting of 4 cantos. Canto 1, which describes the first meeting between Phil, a real ostrich, and Wilbur, an animatronic ostrich, on an LA film set sometime in the early 80s. Phil, not realizing that Wilbur is a machine, engages him in small talk about the recent actor's strike and his annoyance at script changes which have led to major cuts in ostrich screen time. Canto 2, in which Phil collars Wilbur after a hard night's filming and complains about the uncompromising approach of the film's hard-nosed British director and the many takes he demands. Feeling calmer after getting this off his chest, Phil compliments Wilbur on his listening skills and notices for the first time the intriguing glow emanating from the other bird's large, cold, seemingly dead but somehow beautiful eyes. Canto 3, in which Phil finds Wilbur in a corner of the studio backlot and regales him with stories of the strange behaviour of the film's human cast and crew, who seem to be at war with each other. After a time, Phil notices that Wilbur's legs have been removed from his body and starts to suspect that perhaps his new friend isn't all he seems. Canto 4, in which Phil and Wilbur escape from the studio in a truck containing a range of props and pieces of set from the film. Phil tells Wilbur that, although he found his companion's animatronic form initially off-putting, Wilbur now appears as real to Phil as his youthful memories of wild ostriches galloping across the arid plains of Phobos, the first snowfall of winter sparkling ashen grey pink on their starkly monochromatic plumage.
Thanks, Ben.
It's been such a long time.
Oh, we've missed you, Ben.
It's good to have him back, isn't it? Anyway, sorry.
Science. Let's talk about science.
Flying cars?
Flying cars?
Yeah, let's get flying cars.
Apparently a thing, right? So we were promised them in 2017.
Yeah.
But now they're saying 2020.
Who's they?
This is... I'm not actually sure what the company is.
Okay, don't worry.
Because I didn't quite find that out. I got too excited by the other stuff. It's the Aeromobile 4.0, which is an electric flying car that you can drive on the road and also fly.
Ooh.
Which is pretty cool. It's also electric powered, so there's solar panels.
Nice.
Which is pretty awesome. The only drawback is that you do need a runway to take off and fly. So you've got to have quite a substantial bit of land.
Yeah.
And you will also need a pilot's licence to fly it. So, living the dream.
I have another piece of news about those. So Project Vahana is one of the first projects at A-Cubed, which is the advanced project division of Airbus, which is based in Silicon Valley. Their aircraft that they're building doesn't need a runway, and it's self-piloted, so assuming that all goes through, you won't need a pilot license. It's designed for a single passenger. They want to fly a prototype before the end of 2017 and to have a productizable demonstrator by 2020, which, in my opinion, is very ambitious.
Would you want a flying car?
I don't know. Why is it like taking the train. Helicopter? These guys are using a set of rotating propellers, so it can do vertical takeoff, but then fly more like a plane horizontally, which is a lot more efficient than a helicopter, because a helicopter's got to lift its weight all the time, whereas an aeroplane uses the wings.
But if this happened, I want to know how traffic works.
There just isn't any traffic.
You just fly around and there'd be so many crashes.
Yeah.
Well, they'll have to have highways in the sky, which they don't show so much in Blade Runner, but when you see the crowded scenes in that, and Fifth Element's a good one there. You see all the cars going in the same direction at different levels.
Mm. And Attack of the Clones.
Mm.
But let's not talk about that.
No, we don't talk about that.
It's truly awful.
We don't talk about that.
So flying cars seem like we're a decade or two away from realising. Although if you speak to Elon Musk, who set up the Boring Company, he thinks we're all going to go underground. The Boring Company, great name, wants to reduce the cost of tunnelling by an order of magnitude or more. Because tunnels take ages and are really, really, really expensive. But Musk's hypothesis is... you can have different levels of movement underground, and you can go down probably more safely than you can go up. Although there's a lot of considerations there about evacuation and things like that. And,
well, all you'd need really is like a handful of men, and we could start all over again. Yes!
Right, so replicants, nowhere near. Flying cars, reasonably near. What else?
Ooh, holograms.
Holograms.
Holograms. So holograms are a thing, but they're not like a portable device kind of thing, which is what is shown in Blade Runner 2049.
Mm.
But there's been some exciting research from researchers in Australia and China, where you can actually get holograms without needing 3D glasses. And this is because they've developed the materials quite a bit. So the limit currently is to do with optical thickness, because essentially what happens is light is bent in different materials, and the way that they are bent will build up like this 3D picture image. So it can't be made too small, because we don't have enough space to bend all the light into the different 3D structures that we're trying to create. But they've come up with like a composite material, which has got the right refractive index in the bottom half, and then it in the top bit for it to form on the surface of something like a handheld size. So they're calling this the nano hologram, even though it's not really a nano hologram, but I think it's to do with the thickness of the different layers of material.
If they made jukeboxes where you had a little hologram of the singer singing, would you want that?
No, but lots of movies seem to think that we do.
Yeah. Like, it's kind of fun. If it's Frank Sinatra, I get that. That's kind of fun to watch him for a bit. But then you turn away and you get on with his stuff. I'm very happy with this artificial intelligence we've got here. I won't say her name. But I'm very happy. She plays me music all the time. You know, I just ask her anything and she'll play me the music. It's a very good slave I've got here. And
the CIA listen to you all the time?
They're very welcome to listen to but I can't see that it's a lovely film thing. Obviously, it's a beautiful scene. It's fantastic. And apparently, as we all know, Harrison Ford actually punched Ryan Gosling for real by mistake in that scene.
I didn't know that.
Did you not?
No. I quite liked the little jukebox with was it Sinatra on there or the whole Elvis and Marilyn Monroe cabaret thing. I could see it going down well in Vegas.
Well, it's not... there's the holograms of Michael Jackson and Prince. They're doing tours with those sorts of things.
Are they? There was a rapper they brought back from the dead for the first demo of that, didn't they? Coachella.
Oh, right. Okay.
I could see it being popular in some contexts. I'd rather go watch a good movie. But we're watching 3D movies.
Yeah, I don't know if it would just be seen as more of a gimmick than anything else.
It is at the moment, but so are 3D movies.
But in stuff like Star Wars... and Star Trek, when they have like the hologram interactions and they can like walk around the ship and stuff.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Definitely.
And that would be good for like remote investigation of like dangerous areas.
But if you could get a hologram of somebody who was alive, and that would be the way that you could talk to them. For example, I know there are people at Bristol Robotics Lab, we talked to them when we did Big Hero 6, who are making robots which will become a physical presence in people's houses. So people who have got degenerative diseases or are okay living on their own, but if anything changed, then the robots would be able to sense that. And part of that is to have the robot's face would be an iPad screen. So when you Skype in, you could be, your face would be on the robot. I can see that that's kind of the uncanny valley thing is weird, but if you could actually generate a real hologram that was like a Skype call, you know, if we could have a hologram of Professor Ethan Siegel in sitting in the shed with us, that would be a step beyond the Skype thing. Alexa, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe.
Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Ryan. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate.
All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain. Time to die.
We'll come back to Blade Runner 2049 for our second episode on the subject in early November, when we'll be talking to some of the people who made the world, made the film as beautiful as it is. Thank you very much to Ben, Maddie and Steve for joining me here.
Thanks.
Definitely go and watch it.
Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
In case you are unaware, tickets for midnight showing of Star Wars The Last Jedi are available.
Oh my god.
We've got some. We're going to be at the showcase in Bristol.
Yep. 1 minute past midnight on, what is it?
Maybe you should come join us.
Yes, come.
Wednesday or Thursday.
Let's have a shed party in the cinema.
We'll wear our t-shirts so you'll be able to spot us.